Welcome to the African American Hour. I'm Byron Buckner, bringing you 60 minutes of news, commentary, and information about the black community. Today's program will look at the life and works of Jesse Jackson, who died in February of this year. I'll have readings about the civil rights leader, hostage negotiator, and presidential candidate from the New York Times newspaper, the Irish Independent newspaper of Dublin, Ireland, the Chicago Sun-Times, the British Independent newspaper, the military newspaper Stars and Stripes, and I'm starting with this. Jackson served as inspiration for generations of black Democrats. This was written by Reed Epstein and published in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution newspaper on Thursday, February 19, 2026. When Jesse Jackson ran for president in 1984, he was viewed as a protest candidate without the political infrastructure to mount a serious challenge for the Democratic nomination. By the time he ran again 4 years later, Jackson wanted to build a serious campaign. He had spent years registering millions of new black voters and built a fresh kind of multiracial Democratic coalition that included progressive white voters and people of color. Jackson fell short, finishing second in the 1988 primary race, but his campaign created a pathway for scores of black Democrats to run for office while demonstrating for the first time that white Americans would vote for a black presidential candidate. Jesse Jackson provided a building block for campaigns and efforts like mine to be successful, said Carol Mosley Braun, who in 1988 was an Illinois state representative and volunteer for Jackson's campaign, and who 4 years later, with his support, became the first black woman elected to the U.S. Senate. Nobody thought a black person could get elected to anything but a black district. Before Jesse, that was true. But he showed us that black candidates with the right campaign can reach across racial boundaries. In 1972, Shirley Chisholm became the first black candidate for president from a major party, and the Reverend Al Sharpton ran in 2004. But until Barack Obama won the White House in 2008, Jackson's 1988 campaign was the only one to capture enough delegates to be considered a legitimate contender. In the aftermath of Jackson's campaigns, many black politicians made historic leaps to prominent offices. In 1989, L. Douglas Wilder was elected the first black governor of Virginia, and David Dinkins and Norman Rice were elected the first black mayors of New York and Seattle. Also in 1989, Ron Brown became the first black person to lead a major national party when he was elected chair of the Democratic National Committee. 3 years later, Mosley Braun was elected to the Senate, while the number of people of color in the House rose sharply between 1990 and 1992. And Obama's path to his 2008 Democratic primary victory would have been far tougher without changes to the Democratic National Committee delegate allocation system that were demanded by Jackson's allies at the party's 1988 convention in Atlanta. The Jackson delegates forced the party to end a winner-take-all distribution of delegates during the presidential nominating contest. Instead, each state would award delegates proportionally, giving underdog candidates an opportunity to build momentum throughout the primary race. Without Reverend Jackson, there never would have been a Barack Obama, said Donna Brazile, who was a top organizer of Southern states for the 1984 Jackson campaign and went on to serve as acting DNC chair. It was not only black candidates whom Jackson aspired to seek office. The Minnesota state director on his 1988 campaign was a liberal college professor named Paul Wellstone, who in 1990 toppled an incumbent Republican senator. Another supporter, Mayor Bernie Sanders of Burlington, Vermont, was elected the same year to the House, becoming the only Democratic socialist in Congress at the time. In 1992, Bill Clinton won the presidency with the help of a coalition of black and Latino voters, many of whom had been mobilized by Jackson's campaigns. Obama, Sanders, and others who followed Jackson aimed to expand the electorate as he had. Jackson showed that if you wanted to win, you should not just depend on statistics from previous elections to show you who votes. You go out and find new supporters and get them to vote, said Gerald Austin, who was Jackson's campaign manager in 1988. He added that Zohran Mamdani's successful run for New York City mayor last year was an extension of what Jackson did in 88. He won because he involved different races and young people and drew them into a win. Austin, in an interview, recalled attending a party fundraising dinner at a Minneapolis hotel in 1987, at which Jackson and other Democratic presidential candidates spoke. Jackson, he said, spoke last, and when he did, the kitchen staff that had prepared and served the food for the evening emerged into the ballroom to hear Jackson's remarks. They didn't come out for anybody else, Austin said. But this was their first chance to see someone running for president who looked like them. Jackson remained deeply involved in Democratic politics long after his presidential campaign ended. Brazil said that when she was the campaign manager for Vice President Al Gore's White House bid in 2000, Jackson called her every day at 6 a.m. to receive updates and give advice. Jackson's best-known speech is the one he delivered to the 1988 Democratic National Convention in Atlanta, which he concluded with a stirring call to keep hope alive. 20 years later, when Obama ran for president, his campaign's prevailing image was a poster of the Illinois senator behind one word, hope. That was the article titled, Jackson Served as Inspiration for Generations of Black Democrats. This was written by Reed Epstein and published in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution newspaper on Thursday, February 19th, 2026. My next article about Jesse Jackson is titled, Jackson's Rainbow Push Coalition was a powerful advocate for his politics. This was written by Lindsay Schutel and published February 17, 2026 in the New York Times newspaper. The Rainbow Push Coalition, the advocacy organization founded by the Reverend Jesse Jackson, who died on Tuesday, February 17th, was the platform through which the civil rights leader advanced his vision for social justice and his political ambitions. The organization grew out of the work of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, the civil rights group founded by the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and others in 1957. Mr. Jackson became a full-time organizer for the SCLC in 1965, according to his biography on the Rainbow Push Coalition's website. He was soon tapped to run Operation Breadbasket, the group's economic development program. After Dr. King was assassinated in 1968, Mr. Jackson clashed with the other members of Mr. King's inner circle, including the Reverend Ralph David Abernathy, the new head of the SCLC. 3 years later, Mr. Jackson broke away to establish Operation Push, which stood for People United to Save Humanity. Later on, the group changed the S to Serve from Save. The organization began with a focus similar to that of Operation Breadbasket, with the aim of improving the economic opportunities for black communities. It used direct action campaigns to support black businesses. It also pushed companies to hire more black and minority executives and work more with black suppliers. The organization also created inner-city education programs and helped young people find jobs. As Mr. Jackson's ambitions expanded, so did the organization. In 1984, as Mr. Jackson began his first presidential bid, he founded the National Rainbow Coalition in Washington, a social justice campaign group with the aim of changing public policy. In 1996, the organizations merged to become the Rainbow Push Coalition. Still headquartered in Chicago, it has offices nationwide and also became the vehicle for Mr. Jackson's work overseas. More recently, the organization joined a boycott of Target after the retailer rolled back its diversity, equity, and inclusion program in 2025. In January, members of the Rainbow Push Coalition visited Minneapolis after protests there against the Trump administration's immigration enforcement operation. Mr. Jackson retired from his role leading the Rainbow Push Coalition in 2023. That was the article titled, Jackson's Rainbow Push Coalition Was a Powerful Advocate for His Politics. This was written by Lindsay Chattel and published February 17, 2026, in the New York Times newspaper. My next article about Jesse Jackson is titled, With a Plea Over Power, Jesse Jackson Found Success Negotiating Releases of U.S. Troops Held Overseas. This was written by Rose L. Thayer and published February 19, 2026, in the military newspaper Stars and Stripes and its website stripes.com. Navy Lieutenant Robert Goodman marked Christmas Day 1983 under detention of Syrian forces. The A-6 Intruder, a fixed-wing attack plane he was flying with Lieutenant Mark Lang, had been shot down by Syria on December 4, 1983, while on a retaliatory mission over the mountains east of Beirut, Lebanon. Lang did not survive the ejection from the aircraft. Syrian troops took Goodman into custody, holding him first in a basement cell, then in a bedroom of sorts near an office. He recounted in a 2023 article he co-wrote for Windscreen, a magazine for the A6 Intruder community. Soon after Christmas, a group of men came to his room and asked, Do you know Jackson? Unsure what they were getting at, Goodman wrote that he responded, Jesse, Michael, or Reggie. The language barrier left him confused, but Goodman soon learned that the men were referring to the Reverend Jesse Jackson. Jackson had written the Syrian president about Goodman and led a delegation to Syria in what he called a mission of mercy that ultimately freed the pilot. I've been eternally grateful for Reverend Jackson and his family for his efforts in securing my release, Goodman, 69, now a retired commander, said Tuesday, February 17th, after learning of Jackson's death at age 84. Jackson's presence and influence throughout the decades of American history and politics have sometimes overshadowed the significant role he played negotiating the release of military service members held overseas. Twice he secured the release of American troops, first helping Goodman and more than a decade later helping three soldiers held by Serbian forces. James Thomas Jones III, associate professor of African American history at Prairie View A&M University in Texas, said Jackson's secret sauce may have been his ability to come in with a plea and a reminder that the entire world was watching, not presenting a military perspective. If you've had war, conflict, and what have you, this little token, this one moment is something that can prove to be very valuable to you as far as the historical memory goes, and also in regards to how you're viewed by your contemporaries at this present moment, Jones said. Are you willing to work with anyone? And to deny Jackson would be a missed opportunity for a lot of people. As Jackson worked for the release of Goodman, he was also running for president in the Democratic primary, which led to a tense but celebratory White House news briefing January 4, 1984, with President Ronald Reagan, who was up for re-election. Goodman had been freed one day earlier with no concessions from the United States government. Jackson worked outside of it. In Jackson's decision to go, Jones did not see Jackson's motivations as related to race, because Goodman is a black man, but more about politics and strategy. In many ways, he was going to show that he was capable of being presidential and accomplishing things that the sitting American president could not do, Jones said. Jackson described his 3 days of negotiation with Syrian President Hafez al-Assad in Damascus to CBS on the 30th anniversary of Goodman's release. I leaned heavily upon him to not let us go back empty-handed, Jackson said. Our mission was noble. It was for the best in our own country and for the best of Syria at the same time, and because of that, Mr. Assad let him go. This sat in contrast to the efforts made by the Reagan administration, Jones said. You have Reagan, and you have American military leaders who believe that might is right, he said. Jackson instead presented an opportunity where humanity can show it can reign, Jones said. Jackson continued from there to get involved in negotiating the release of Americans held in Cuba, Iraq, Gambia, and during the hijacking of TWA Flight 847 in 1985. His work again involved detained military troops in 1999, when three soldiers were captured by Serbian forces. Staff Sergeant Christopher Stone, Staff Sergeant Andrew Ramirez, and Specialist Stephen Gonzalez were on a NATO observation patrol on March 31, 1999, when Serbian troops took them by force and accused them of crossing illegally into Yugoslavia along the Macedonian border. Jackson led a religious delegation that secured their release on May 2, 1999. Major General David L. Grange, then commander of the 1st Infantry Division, stated in an Army release he was grateful for Jackson's help. "Jackson had told me it was a tough sell, but that he would be successful, and he was," Grange said. Gonzalez later told PBS about his release and said he didn't believe it was real until "we were able to walk across that floor and go hug Reverend Jackson and then call our families." Jackson again, Jones said, brought a persuasive power that was not associated with military forces. That was the article titled, "With a Plea Over Power, Jesse Jackson Found Success Negotiating Releases of U.S. Troops Held Overseas." This was written by Rose Thayer and published in the military newspaper Stars and Stripes at its stripes.com website on February 19, 2026. My next reading is titled, "Key Quotes from the Reverend Jesse Jackson That Define His Political Views." This was published February 17, 2026, in the British newspaper The Independent. The Reverend Jesse Jackson, who died Tuesday, February 17, at the age of 84, was known not just as a tireless advocate for the civil rights movement, but as one of his most dynamic orators. He spoke tirelessly for the poor and marginalized on issues from voting rights to housing. Jackson also gave numerous speeches as the leader of the Rainbow Push Coalition and as a presidential candidate in the 1980s. In his later years, he did the same for the Black Lives Matter movement. Here are some notable and defining words from Jackson. At the Democratic National Convention in 1984, during his first run for president, he said, "America is not like a blanket. One piece of unbroken cloth, the same color, the same texture, the same size. America is more like a quilt. Many patches, many pieces, many colors, many sizes, all woven and held together by a common thread." He offered encouragement in his convention speech 4 years later, when he nearly captured the 1988 Democratic nomination. "You must not surrender. You may or may not get there, but just know that you're qualified and you hold on and hold out. You must never surrender. America will get better and better. Keep hope alive. Keep hope alive. Keep hope alive. On tomorrow night and beyond, keep hope alive." To students at Kansas State University in November 1993 about taking a stand against the rise in violent crime, he said, "At this stage, we are on the defensive as a struggle, as a humane struggle. Fear, it is pushing hope back. Cowardice is pushing courage back. Death is taking the joy of life. Dope is outdistancing hope. Escapism is outdistancing embrace. When youth come alive, you have the energy, the strength, the need, and the moral authority to make America better and the whole world more secure." In Virginia, at the dedication of the Martin Luther King Jr. Bridge in September 2008, he said of the new span, "It must lead to more futures and fewer young funerals. It must embrace Dr. King's last dream, a poor people's campaign, where all could come together with a job, income, education, and health care. A bridge that leads us from racial battleground to economic common ground. It leads us to healing." To students at the Cambridge Union Society in England in December 2013, he said, "Common ground leads to coalition, to cooperation, to reconciliation and redemption, and to higher moral and economic ground. The challenge of this new world, so connected by technology, is yours to bear and yours to share. I want to say to you young people especially, keep reaching beyond your grasp. Keep dreaming beyond your circumstances. Keep dreaming of a new Europe. When young people move, the world changes. That was the article titled, Key Quotes from the Reverend Jesse Jackson that Define His Political Views. This appeared in the British newspaper The Independent on Tuesday, February 17th, 2026. My next reading about Jesse Jackson is titled, In Africa, Jesse Jackson was esteemed for his fight against apartheid. This was written by John Elagon and published February 17, 2026 at the nytimes.com website. Jesse Jackson lobbied Pope John Paul II and the Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev to rebuke South Africa's apartheid government. He called on Harvard University to divest from the country. And he was there when Nelson Mandela was released from Robben Island in 1990 after serving 27 years as a political prisoner. Just as Mr. Jackson, who died on February 17th, became synonymous with the civil rights movement in the United States, he was esteemed across Africa, particularly for his vigorous activism against the apartheid regime in South Africa. Mr. Jackson first visited South Africa in 1979, 2 years after the killing of the anti-apartheid activist Steve Biko. He drew massive crowds at rallies in Soweto, a deeply impoverished township where the white minority government forced black people to live. In the decades that followed, he made several trips back to other countries in Africa as a peace broker and a representative of Black America, who showed that the U.S. government's acceptance of apartheid did not align with the views of many of its citizens. We were deeply indebted to the energy, principled clarity, and personal risk with which he supported our struggle and campaign for freedom and equality in other parts of the world, President Cyril Ramaphosa of South Africa said in a statement on February 17th. Mr. Jackson's devotion to the anti-apartheid struggle stemmed from the parallels he saw with the fight for civil rights in the United States. As a young civil rights activist, I knew how raw and ugly and violent the apartheid regime was, he wrote in an opinion column in The Guardian in 2013. They were being jailed. We were being jailed. We were being killed, and they were being massacred. In 1986, Mr. Jackson took a whirlwind 8-country tour of Africa where he was greeted by huge crowds, red carpet, state dinners, and lengthy meetings with heads of state. In Zambia, he delivered a speech that moved Kenneth Kaunda, the country's president at the time, to tears. He sought to make Americans aware of the ripple effects that apartheid was having in the region and vowed to push President Ronald Reagan to support the nations surrounding South Africa. Mr. Jackson would return to Africa in the late 1990s as an envoy for President Bill Clinton, working to intervene in conflicts in the Democratic Republic of Congo, Sierra Leone, Zambia, and Nigeria. On Tuesday, February 17th, President Bola Tinubu of Nigeria recognized his work in a statement. Reverend Jesse Jackson is a great friend of Nigeria and Africa. That was the New York Times article titled, In Africa, Jesse Jackson was esteemed for his fight against apartheid. This was written by John Elagon and published February 17th, 2026. My next reading is titled, Reverend Jesse Jackson, Civil Rights Leader and Chicago Icon, Dead at 84. This obituary was written by Neil Steinberg and published February 17, 2026, in the Chicago Sun-Times newspaper. I may be poor, began the call and response Reverend Jesse Jackson led in various forms before rapt audiences for more than half a century. But I am somebody. I may be on welfare, but I am somebody. I may be in jail, but I am somebody. I may be uneducated, but I am somebody. I am black, beautiful, proud. I must be respected. I must be protected. I am somebody. That, in essence, is the message Reverend Jackson devoted his life to championing, for black people in general and himself in particular. From leading Reverend Martin Luther King Jr.'s open housing campaign in Chicago in 1964, through his close association with the great civil rights leader during the last 3 years of King's life, to the tumultuous 1970s, when Jackson started what became the Rainbow Push Coalition, to the 1980s, when he ran the first viable presidential campaign by a black candidate in the United States, to the 1990s, when he traveled the globe to free hostages, advise leaders, join picket lines, and lend his internationally famous name to often desperate causes, to his later years, when he settled into the role as a reverend elder statesman of black Chicago and an unceasing voice for social justice. Reverend Jackson died at age 84 on Tuesday, February 17th, his family said in a statement. He had been in declining health for a decade. In 2017, he announced he had been diagnosed with Parkinson's disease 2 years earlier, but last April revealed that it was actually misdiagnosed progressive supranuclear palsy, a condition also affecting bodily movements. He stepped down as president of PUSH in July 2023, citing health concerns. Reverend Jackson appeared on stage at the Democratic National Convention in Chicago in August 2024 when he was presented to the crowd after a video celebrating his life, but did not speak. If the legend of his mentor, Martin Luther King, was simplified, almost beatified by early death, a martyr at 39, an icon who had a dream, then the legacy of his eager protege was complicated by long life. Reverend Jesse Jackson was in the public eye for 6 decades, a tireless wielder of social pressure. He was respected and dismissed, inspiring adoration and disdain, a Chicago institution who left footprints on the world stage, an ardent advocate for civil rights whose attempts to wield political power himself were thwarted and channeled into the power of protest, persuasion, and complaint. Yet there are doubts and criticisms raised about this complex man, a man characterized by ambiguity and contradiction, the New York Times Magazine wrote about him in 1972. He is a brilliant speaker, a skilled mobilizer. He is also vain and self-seeking, a star, a man of great ambition, a man who at times uses the tricks of a demagogue, which is another way to describe a powerful orator who inspired and uplifted millions of people, whether one-on-one or through the media he played skillfully around the world. In everything he did, Jackson was always pushing to be counted and make a difference, to be somebody. He was born under highly unpromising circumstances on October 8, 1941 in Greenville, South Carolina, in a 3-room, 10-roofed house without running water. His mother was an unwed 16-year-old high school student named Helen Burns. His father, Noah Robinson, was a married neighbor more than twice her age, 33, with 3 stepchildren. When Jesse was a toddler, his mother married Charles Jackson, who adopted Jesse when he was about 12. Charles Jackson worked as a janitor, and sometimes young Jesse would help him clean buildings. It was a deeply segregated time and place. When baseball star Jackie Robinson came to Greenville for the NAACP, he wasn't allowed to use the bathroom at the airport. Young Jesse was taunted for his stammer, which would return in moments of excitement later in life. His mother was his first adoring audience. She always told him, Reverend Jackson later recalled, "You're going to be somebody." His calling came early. Jesse was an unusual kind of fella. Even when he was just learning to talk, Robinson remembered, he would say he's going to be a preacher. He would say, "I'm going to lead people through the rivers of water." Jackson was drawn to Chicago by an uncle, Henry Williams, who lived at 61st and Vernon and worked at the U.S. Postal Service's Englewood Station, but often returned south. "He would travel back home in the summertime to visit," Reverend Jackson wrote. "After his stay, we went with him to the station, and it was so sad when the train would pull off. how we desperately wanted to accompany him, bound for Chicago. He got his wish at 15, when he was put on the train, fortified with his mother's ham sandwiches, hard-boiled eggs, sweet potato pie, and a jug of lemonade. God, he thought, arriving at the 63rd Street station, I'm in Chicago. He was amazed that on Cottage Grove, he could sit and eat at the lunch counter at Walgreens, something he couldn't do at home, where he attended the segregated Sterling High School. The 6'2" student was a three-letter high school athlete, baseball, basketball, and football. In 1959, he went to the University of Illinois at Champaign-Urbana on an athletic scholarship. It was during a trip home to Greenville for his first Christmas break that Reverend Jackson was drawn, quite by accident, into the civil rights struggle. He was supposed to write a speech on patriotism, ironically, but the books he needed were not available at the McBee Avenue Colored Branch of the Greenville Public Library. The librarian there sent him with an explanatory note to the main whites-only library downtown, naively phoning ahead, thinking to smooth the way. What the call did was make sure two police officers were waiting for him as he walked to the library. He tried to get the books he needed. The police threatened to arrest him if he didn't leave without them. The humiliation stung. I had to break off my Christmas vacation 4 days early to get back to Illinois to get that speech done, Reverend Jackson told the New Yorker in 1992. I remember riding that train alone back to Atlanta and to Nashville and up to Chicago and on the bus back to Urbana, thinking the whole way, that library's public. And when I get back home this summer, it's going to go public for real. I'm going to use that library. And so he did. On July 18, 1960, he returned with 7 friends, went into the reading room and looked at books, refusing demands that they leave. The police came and arrested them for disorderly conduct, and they became the Greenville Eight. The subsequent lawsuit led to a ruling that the libraries must be desegregated. Greenville instead shut down all its public libraries, blaming those who tried to use them. The efforts being made by a few Negroes to use the white library will now deprive all white and Negro citizens of the benefit of a library, Greenville Mayor J. Kenneth Cass said in a statement. Prejudice was not limited to the South. Disappointed with the racial isolation and slights he found in Illinois, Reverend Jackson transferred to North Carolina Agricultural and Technical College in Greensboro before his junior year. There he met a first-year student named Jackie Davis Brown. He looked at me and he said, "Hey girl, I'm going to marry you," she told Frontline, which totally offended me because at that time I had no interest in being tied down with children and a family and a responsibility. They married on New Year's Eve, 1962. Jackson graduated with a bachelor's degree in sociology in 1964. In 1965, he and his wife and daughter Santita moved to the city, living near 68th and Cottage Grove, while he studied at the Chicago Theological Seminary. Reverend Jackson was an excellent student who got a D in preaching because he refused to write out his sermons ahead of time. That Jesse, he's a very brilliant guy, but undisciplined, said the Reverend Victor Obenhaus, Jackson's faculty advisor and a professor of Christian ethics. We had very rigid requirements. One has to do with articulating your philosophical and theological groundwork. Jesse couldn't do that in a coherent fashion. As with so many others, Jackson was energized by television coverage of the police attacks on civil rights marchers in Selma in March 1965. He urged his fellow students to put their abstract notions of faith into action, and 30 joined him driving down to Alabama, where Jackson met King advisor Ralph Abernathy. Reverend Jackson insisted he be given a job and an audience with King, and was granted the latter. He urged King to bring his work to Chicago, an uncommon local view, since the most influential Chicago black ministers were in Mayor Richard Daley's back pocket, and would hold a televised news conference urging King to stay away. In February 1966, Reverend Jackson started reaching out to local congregations for help starting what he called a ministry of jobs. By April, 400 ministers had signed on, and Reverend Jackson expanded the Southern Christian Leadership Conference's Operation Breadbasket to Chicago. The first business approached, the Country Delight Dairy, refused to cooperate. for a while. 3 days after a boycott was announced, 44 new or upgraded jobs for blacks were found at the dairy. Reverend Jackson began with dairies. He later explained, because it is particularly vulnerable, milk can't stand around. It has to be sold or the man suffers a loss. Jackson also became a voice on the Chicago political scene. In March 1966, when Daley allowed Prince Philip to address the city council, Reverend Jackson wondered why the royal had been welcomed while King was turned away. Dr. King's mission is more serious than Prince Philip's, Reverend Jackson said. In August 1966, Reverend Jackson led a march against housing restrictions, guiding 300 supporters, outnumbered 7-1 by a jeering, missile-throwing crowd of 2,000 whites carrying Confederate flags and signs reading, "Keep out black trash," while hurling bottles, rocks, and cherry bombs. The marchers turned back after police threatened to arrest the protesters. On April 4, 1968, King stepped out onto the second-floor balcony at the Lorraine Motel in Memphis, Tennessee. Reverend Jackson was in the parking lot below. "Our leader," he cried. "Jesse," King said, "I want you to come to dinner with me tonight." "Doc, Jesse took care of that before you did," said Reverend Billy Kiles, a minister who had urged King to come to Memphis. "He got himself invited." Moments later, a single shot cut down King. Reverend Jackson flew to Chicago, where he appeared on television, wearing the same bloody tan turtleneck he had on the evening before, claiming he had cradled King's head as he died. "On my chest is a stain of blood from Dr. King's head," Reverend Jackson told the cameras. The claim drew furious denunciation from King's inner circle and caused bitterness that lasted for years. "I looked around and sure enough, Jesse Jackson's shirt was drenched in blood," King confidant Hosea Williams said. "And I realized the only way Jesse could have gotten that blood was stooped down on that floor of the Lorraine Motel, and he raked that blood off the floor and put that blood on him." Jackson biographer Marshall Frady viewed the act in the context of the tendency of followers of slain prophets to preserve the blood of their fallen martyrs, observing that, even if Williams were correct, the act amounts to a kind of anointing with King's very blood, one proving prophetic in light of subsequent events. "To a considerable degree," Frady wrote, "in the national activation of the black voting rights won by King and Selma, in his perpetuation of King's vision in the national life, in his ascent to become almost a totemic figure for America's black community, Jackson is proved to be probably King's single notably legatee." Reverend Jackson was ordained at Fellowship Missionary Baptist Church on June 30, 1968. Constantly clashing with the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, or SNCC, back in Atlanta, Reverend Jackson formed his own organization, originally called People United to Save Humanity, but gradually morphing into the Rainbow Push Coalition. Time magazine devoted a special issue to Black America 1970 in April of that year. Any one of a dozen such grassroots leaders could be used to symbolize the ways in which black gains, however modest, are being achieved in communities, Time wrote, before singling out the minister whose face was on the cover. "One who is more articulate and arresting than most is Reverend Jesse Jackson, an intense, passionate advocate for using black economic power." In the late 1970s, Jackson began to travel as an international mediator and advocate. In South Africa, he condemned apartheid as ungodly, denouncing its government as a terroristic dictatorship, and making more of a stir among both blacks and whites than any American political figure to come here in many years, the Washington Post reported. Reverend Jackson's breakout year was 1983, when he crisscrossed the country registering black voters. Shortly before the Democratic National Committee in July 1984, Jackson embarked on a tour of Central America. In Nicaragua, he condemned financing the anti-Sandinista insurgents by Ronald Reagan's administration. In Cuba, he met with Fidel Castro, negotiated the release of 22 American prisoners, and brought them back to the United States. "I did it for him," said Castro, insisting that he had freed the prisoners as a result of Reverend Jackson's visit. Jackson ran as a candidate himself in 1984 and did well in the Democratic primaries, garnering 21% of the vote. After Reverend Jackson was quoted in an interview by a friendly black reporter calling Jews Haimies in New York City, Haimietown, his campaign became bogged down in controversy, particularly after Nation of Islam leader Louis Farrakhan, whose Fruit of Islam provided security to Reverend Jackson, threatened to kill the reporter and his wife, and Reverend Jackson was slow to repudiate Farrakhan's words. The rift with the Jewish community would take years to heal, and was widened by Reverend Jackson's embrace of Yasser Arafat and the cause of Palestinian independence. In 1988, Reverend Jackson ran again and did even better, earning 29% of the primary ballots, 7 million votes. Jackson moved from Chicago to Washington in 1989, where he ran for one of two shadow senator positions created by the District of Columbia Council to lobby for D.C. statehood inside Congress. He used that six-year term, which came with no salary, office, or budget, to advance his Rainbow Coalition agenda. Instead of pushing for a third presidential run in 1992, Jackson pulled back from politics, recasting himself as a TV commentator, appearing on CNN for 8 years. After Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait and threatened to scatter Western hostages to sites that might be attacked by American airstrikes, Reverend Jackson went to Baghdad and negotiated their release. The moment reflects the duality of Reverend Jackson's career. He traveled around the world to free hundreds of people who might otherwise have perished in the coming year, yet returned home to face indifference and questions as to whether he should have gone at all. Reverend Jackson remained in the thick of politics in the 1990s as President Bill Clinton took office, and Jesse Jackson Jr., his second oldest child, was elected to fill a seat vacated by U.S. Representative Mel Reynolds, who resigned in 1995 after a jury convicted him of a sexual assault charge. After an initially rocky relationship, Reverend Jackson became an advisor and friend to Clinton, counseling him during the hearings leading to the president's impeachment by the House and subsequent acquittal by the Senate. In 1997, Jackson accepted a Clinton appointment as Special Envoy of the President and Secretary of State for the Promotion of Democracy in Africa. In that role, he visited troubled republics from Nigeria to the Congo, met with leaders including Nelson Mandela of South Africa, Daniel Arap Moi of Kenya, and Frederick Chiluba of Zambia, and engaged in government-sanctioned negotiations. In war-torn Sierra Leone on May 24, 1999, he brokered a ceasefire between President Tejan Kaba and rebel leader Fode Sanko. In 2000, he received the nation's highest civilian honor, the Presidential Medal of Freedom. Reverend Jackson acknowledged in 2001 that he'd had an extramarital affair after the National Enquirer learned of Jackson's relationship with Rainbow Push employee Karen Stanford. The couple had a daughter in May 1999. I fully accept responsibility, and I am truly sorry for my actions, Reverend Jackson said. As her mother does, I love this child very much and have assumed responsibility for her emotional and financial support since she was born. I was born of these circumstances, and I know the importance of growing up in a nurturing, supportive, and protected environment. Reverend Jackson kept a low profile after the scandal, but the rise of Barack Obama prompted him to seek credit for the changes he helped bring. It was hard for Jackson to see the younger man strive for and achieve the true political power, insider power, that had always eluded him, quietly lobbying for recognition of his role in the ascent of Obama, for laying the groundwork. But in unguarded moments, he was less diplomatic, sometimes saying Obama was too white, or talked down to black people, once muttering, "I want to cut his nuts off," into an open Fox News microphone. Obama diplomatically ignored Reverend Jackson, who apologized, but whose antipathy remained. He ended up fighting the people he helped make way for, Reverend Al Sharpton said of Jackson. It didn't help that Jesse Jackson Jr.'s political and personal life fell apart, just as Obama's was peaking, and Jackson's namesake, who had larger ambitions himself, ended up disgraced and in prison. Plaudits poured out in July 2023 when Jackson stepped down as head of the Rainbow Push Coalition. Through decades of service, he has led the Rainbow Push Coalition at the forefront of the struggle for civil rights and social justice, said Mayor Brandon Johnson. His faith and his perseverance, his love, and his relentless dedication to people inspire all of us to keep pushing for a better tomorrow. Asked by the Washington Post in 1983 how he wanted to be remembered, Reverend Jackson replied, "I did the best I could with what I had, and I gave my best against the odds." Survivors include his wife Jacqueline and their five children, Santita, Jesse Jr., Jonathan, Yusef, and Jackie. He also had a sixth child, Ashley, in 1999 with Karen Stanford. That was the Chicago Sun-Times newspaper obituary titled, "Reverend Jesse Jackson, Civil Rights Leader and Chicago Icon, Dead at 84. It was written by Neil Steinberg and published February 17, 2026. My next reading about Jesse Jackson is a commentary from Dublin, Ireland. The title is, "From Selma to Dublin and Belfast, How Jackson Touched Ireland with His Energy." This was written by Donald Fallon and published February 19, 2026 in the Irish Independent newspaper. When the Northern Ireland Civil Rights Association, NICRA, first emerged in 1967, its detractors insisted it was little more than a Republican front and a Trojan horse that would use the language of reform in pursuit of revolution. In truth, it was a movement that sought only the fundamental rights promised to citizens, even drawing its constitution from that of the British National Council for Civil Liberties. In pursuit of one man, one vote, and other reforms, NICRA highlighted the hypocrisy of a society that claimed to be a democratic one, yet continued to discriminate against sections of its population. Just as the American abolitionist Frederick Douglass had shown light on American society and asked, "What to the slave is the 4th of July?" NICRA asked awkward questions of those in power in Britain for denying sections of the population proper representation or rights. After 47 years of effective dictatorship, NICRA insisted, the people had enough. They wanted only what they had been promised. In time, even Ian Paisley would come to recognize the fairness of their demands, acknowledging in a 2014 interview, "It wasn't fair. A fair government is that every man has the same power to vote for what he wants. No, it wasn't justice at all." That "We Shall Overcome" became the anthem synonymous with NICRA said much of the influence of the American Civil Rights Movement on it. Indeed, "We Shall Overcome" was the title later chosen for NICRA's official history. Marches and sit-in protests looked directly to the American example and the insistence of the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. of the creative power of nonviolence as the force which is capable of winning lasting and meaningful brotherhood and peace. Placards at demonstrations for housing reform across Northern Ireland evoked Alabama, while in America itself the leading civil rights organizations could praise the valorous efforts of the Catholic minority in Northern Ireland to secure political, economic, and social rights. The marches from Selma to Montgomery had their first Irish equivalent in NICRA's march from Coal Island to Dungannon in August 1968. One of those present at Selma was Jesse Jackson, who later maintained that, in many ways, Selma is the birthplace of modern democracy in America. Aged just 24, Jackson would come to prominence in King's Southern Christian Leadership Conference as its youngest staff member and an energetic voice in the media. Jackson's leadership of Operation Breadbasket, a movement seeking to reduce unemployment in black communities by building new networks and supporting black-owned businesses, brought him to national and international prominence. One of its weapons was a tactic first forged in Ireland and taking its name from an unpopular and ostracized landlord, the boycott. Throughout Jackson's long political life, Ireland featured in sometimes surprising ways. While many obituaries acknowledge his support for the Good Friday Agreement, less familiar will be his visit to Dublin's North Inner City in 1982, when in a packed church in Sean McDermott Street, he spoke movingly about the discrimination he had worked to undo in his own country and about the brutal effects of poverty there. In a part of Dublin that had been ravaged by drugs, with the opiate crisis devastating young lives, community activist Peg McManus remembered him like an exotic bird that had flown across the seas into the church, a tall, handsome man of immense passion, singing a song of freedom. Jackson brought hope of the possibilities of better times in a speech that gave young people a sense of hope in their futures. Better recalled is Jackson's visit to the Museum of Free Dairy in 2017, when he cut the ribbon of the newly restored space. On an earlier visit, he had stood at the Free Dairy Corner with Eamon McCann, Martin McGuinness, and John Hume, all defining figures in the history of the city who had trod different paths in the late 1960s. McCann, eyewitness to the horror of Bloody Sunday in the Bogside, later recalled that, "On the day it was just like a thunderclap. It took some time after all the killings to quite get it into one's head what had actually just transpired on the streets." Opening the museum dedicated to that tragic event, Jackson spoke of it as part of the healing process of history, in a language he often used when speaking in the United States. The tragedies of the past could not be undone, but healing and learning could follow from them. As an orator, Jackson was almost without parallel in modern American politics. His deep faith could lead to the occasional brilliant rhetorical flourish, like his evocation of the Bible in his speech before the Democratic National Convention in 1988, when he told the crowd that, "If lions and lambs can find common ground, surely we can as well as civilized people." He presented racism to the American public as something that was not alone un-American, but fundamentally un-Christian. Still, he did not limit his political playing field to the states. Commenting on the significance of Jackson, the American novelist James Baldwin believed he was important because of his global presence, something that manifested itself in the enormous crowds who went to hear him speak in Soweto during his 1979 visit to South Africa. In Ireland, he will be remembered for visits to places as diverse as East Belfast and Sean McDermott Street. That was the commentary titled, "From Selma to Dublin and Belfast, How Jackson Touched Ireland with His Energy." This was written by Donald Fallon and published in the Irish Independent newspaper on February 19, 2026. My final reading about Jesse Jackson is titled, "When Jesse Jackson Went to Sesame Street," with the credo, "I am somebody." A young black man sits on a brownstone stoop, his hair in an afro, a medallion around his neck the size of one of Cookie Monster's favorite treats. Before him is a crowd of children of different races and ethnicities. "Here we go," he tells them. "I am," he says. "I am," they repeat. "Somebody." The young man is the civil rights leader Jesse Jackson. The stoop is on the set of Sesame Street in 1972. The call and response is a version of one that Jackson, who died on Tuesday, February 17th at 84, led at rallies for years and recorded on an album. And the scene remains one of the most stirring minutes of children's TV ever produced. The cultural reach of Jim Henson's Muppets is so great that we can forget that Sesame Street, first and foremost, is a show about kids. The kids here are boys and girls of many ages and sizes. But what they were being told is that they are people. They are not learning to be people. They are not playing at what it will be like to grow up and become people. They are people already with the same entitlement to dignity as any towering grown-up. They take the message in and belt it back. "I may be small, but I am somebody. I may be on welfare, but I am somebody. I am black, brown, white. I speak a different language, but I must be respected, protected, never rejected. I am God's child. I am somebody." The kids kick their feet and fidget. Some answer with gusto. Some mouth the words shyly. But there is something potent in the moment, the tiniest, most vulnerable members of society declaring that they have value and deserve respect. After all, what is a child's first experience of rebellion and conflict with authority? In some version of, I am a person too, you need to listen to me. It's hard to imagine the Sesame Street of today, whose new episodes now land on Netflix, airing a statement like this, or either the references to God or to welfare. But at its inception, Sesame Street very much was a statement. It was dedicated, like public TV generally, to reaching every part of the public. It was noticeably inclusive, to the point of encountering racist complaints and bans over its diverse casting. Jackson's appearance underlines that message. Here he does not speak with the fire of a protest leader or a politician. He's like a hip teacher or a youth group leader. He engages and encourages the kids in the tones of a classroom. He is perhaps asking us to imagine that this is what classrooms could be like. The message of Jackson's litany is the beginning of education and the beginning of democracy. It says that you have worth as a person simply because you are a person. It says that you have a voice, and it says that your voice is most powerful when it joins with other voices. Jesse Jackson was a lot of things as a political figure. What we see here is how much he was a true populist. His politics were centered on people, as a people. And he emphasized that any movement that brought people together had first to affirm the importance of personhood. Watching the Sesame Street video today, I can't help but think about those kids on the set. They would be well into middle age today. Maybe they have children, even grandchildren. They've lived long enough to see that people don't always live by the lessons they recite in school, that not everyone, in fact, has his or her somebody-ness acknowledged equally. Chance can't make the world perfect, nor can educational kids' shows. They just give you tools for life, like arithmetic and the ABCs. All of us Sesame Street kids had to go out into the world and apply those tools ourselves. But at least, if there comes a moment when you have to speak up, it helps to remember when a grown-up cared enough to tell you that you deserve to be heard. That was the commentary titled, When Jackson Went to Sesame Street with the Credo, I Am Somebody. This was written by James Poniewozik and published in the New York Times newspaper on February 18th, 2026. That's all for this week. If you would like to listen to this program again or past editions of the African American Hour, you can find them wherever you get your podcasts or in the archives at the Audio Reader Network of the University of Kansas at the website reader.ku.edu. I'm Byron Buckner, and thank you for listening to the African American Hour.